Okay, we're fortunate to hear about cost effectiveness today from Kyle. He's only been here a little while. I don't know how long in total, but less than a year, right?
Yep, I came in July.
Yeah.
July, the beginning of the academic year.
And so this is a perfect topic.
Why did you come here?
Oh, my wife's from here.
You're on faculty?
I am the current endocrine surgery fellow at UCLA, and I also take attending general surgery call at Santa Monica Hospital. I'm a clinical instructor of general surgery.
Right.
And I did a health services research fellowship during the lab years of my general surgery residency.
Where?
At Northwestern.
With David Baker?
Well, David Baker was peripherally involved, but I know that he trained here or did his fellowship here, and I certainly told him I was coming here when I matched here for the fellowship. He was excited for me. Very nice guy.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of slides to go through. I'd like to get started, but I'm going to be talking to you. I have no conflicts of interest. I'm going to be talking to you about primary hyperparathyroidism and my quality of life and cost effectiveness research in this discipline. For those that are not as familiar with the disease process, I'm going to give a brief overview of hyperparathyroidism and the anatomy and function of the parathyroid glands. And then I'm going to move through and talk about the problem of so-called asymptomatic primary hyperparathyroidism. And then I'll talk about my research and what's known about quality of life in primary hyperparathyroidism. So first, anatomy and function. So who here has heard of primary hyperparathyroidism? Has everybody heard of that disease process? Yeah? Because I wasn't sure, you know, there are health service research fellows here. Not everyone's heard of it. No one had heard of it before the year 1850, and it started with that rhinoceros. There was a beloved Indian rhinoceros in the London Zoo who unfortunately had it going with some of the elephants in the pen, and they attacked it and gave it a pneumothorax, and the rhinoceros passed away. And enter Sir Richard Owen. He was a professor of comparative anatomy at the Royal College of Surgeons in London, a contemporary of Charles Darwin and a rival of his. And he took it upon himself to dissect the rhinoceros. And he did this in his carriage house. It was a very smelly affair from what was reported. However, during the dissection, he identified what he called a small, compact, yellow glandular body attached to the thyroid, but not the thyroid itself. It was where the thyroid veins emerged. And I know now that that's probably an inferior parathyroid gland, or the thyrothymic tract connecting the thymus and the veins of the thymus and the thyroid. And there it is right there. That was the very first time that a parathyroid gland was identified. The function was unknown. However, it was repeatedly identified by a Swedish medical student in 1880 in several different mammals, including a dog, a rabbit, a cat, a horse, and finally a human cadaver. The parathyroid is thought to be the last major organ that was recognized in humans. Here's what they look like. They're kind of stuck to the back of the thyroid gland. They're usually quite small. The normal parathyroid is said to weigh around 35 milligrams. Usually they're in a fairly preserved embryologic location. However, there can be ectopic glands all the way down here by the arch of the aorta or in the carotid sheath. And occasionally a person will have a fifth gland in one of those ectopic locations, but most people have four parathyroid glands. The function... these are like my notes that are popping up here.
Yeah, you know what? That happens sometimes.
It's all right.
It's all right. Well, you get this. That might add a little color to the talk. So the function of the parathyroids our calcium regulation. Maybe this is too basic for the people in the room, but the parathyroid senses the calcium concentration in the blood, and now I'm in this zone where I had to go back. Difficult to do that on this. Okay. So through a variety of mechanisms, it stimulates bone resorption, more gut absorption. It tells the kidney to make more vitamin D, which tells the gut to absorb more calcium. All these things lead to increased serum calcium. That's the normal way that the parathyroid gland regulates calcium concentration in the blood. That's not advancing. Okay. So now for the pathophysiology of primary hyperparathyroidism. Usually, hyperparathyroidism occurs because of a single parathyroid adenoma, benign tumor that is over-secreting parathyroid hormone, autonomously functioning, you know, some little genetic aberration, clonal copy. It stops listening to how much calcium sensor doesn't work, and it just makes parathyroid hormone independently. It can be caused by some rare genetic disorders, but usually it's just a sporadic event that occurs, and not super uncommon. One in 400 people will develop it. That's what they say the incidence is. Not super rare. And then pathophysiologically, what happens is the parathyroid hormone goes up, and bone resorption increases, and that leads to hypercalcemia and a state of bone density loss. So the classic signs and symptoms, if you went to medical school, you probably learned this in medical school. The stones, bones, groans, and psychiatric moans. People get kidney stones, calcium-based kidney stones. Osteoporosis, like I already talked about, which leads to fragility fractures from low bone density. The abdominal groans, classically seen with very high levels of calcium causing peptic ulcers, and also patients with primary hyperpara get constipation. And then there's this whole body of psychiatric symptoms, lethargy, fatigue, depression, which are well described, but kind of considered.
Do you ever see any of these symptoms with mild hypercalcemia, or does it need to be in a severe range?
Yeah, good question. A lot of people have mild biochemical disease, calcium levels, 10.3, 10.4, PTH levels 80. 120, and they're symptomatic as can be. I mean, they just complain of all the things in the book. And we wonder, is there something about the parathyroid hormone that is causing them to be symptomatic? Is parathyroid hormone somehow, activating a pathway? Because mild hypercalcemia shouldn't be symptomatic.
All right, I might refer a patient to you.
Please. I'll give you my card.
So you're setting it up, like you can see here. You're talking about 800,000 people in the U.S. will develop parathyroidism. That's about 10,000 people a year.
Yeah,
that would be a lot of surgery.
Well, we think 140,000 a year. Get it? That's what we think.
Develop.
Yeah. So 700 million, and then I said, I think women it's more common, men it's a little less common. And the incidence is somewhere between 1 in 200, 1 in 600, something like that. I don't know. I could work out the math, but
anyway.
Yeah. A fair number of people have prior hyperparathyroidism.
Yeah, often do it. There's just a regression of head dividing their head too many.
Right.
The more the wrinkles happen.
They had calculators.
They can't tie their shoes either.
So, the diagnosis and treatment of primary hyperparathyroidism is biochemical. The lab tests provide the diagnosis. You have either an elevated serum calcium and an elevated serum parathyroid hormone or an inappropriately normal serum parathyroid hormone level. And after it's biochemically confirmed, we do imaging studies to localize the adenoma. And this can be done with CAT scan, thin cuts, or a nuclear medicine study, a sestamibi scan. And the treatment is surgical removal of the adenoma. And sometimes there's four-gland hyperplasia, and we do a subtotal parathyroidectomy where we leave half of one gland in. So this is some Swedish cancer registry data from 1960 and 1981, and it kind of sheds some light on the history of the diagnosis and treatment of primary hyperparathyroidism. For some reason, prior to 1970, the incidence was a lot lower. And there's this New England Journal article. This New England Journal article in 1980 looked at Rochester, Mayo group looked at primary hyperparathyroid incidence, and you can see it very similar to that Swedish study. The incidence was low before mid 70s, and then much higher. So what's going on here?
Because it's the incidence of detection.
That's right.
Diagnosis.
That's exactly right. Yeah, so it says here, in July 74, they added calcium to the autoanalyzer. So, yes, the autoanalyzer is to blame. That's why we were able to detect
it.
A little spike was due to water.
There's no conflict of interest.
So the disease presentation has changed dramatically. Prior to the autoanalyzer, we saw patients with severe fragility fractures, bad kidney stones, ulcers. And then after the autoanalyzer, now suddenly we're dealing with, these people that had no overt symptoms, or possibly, I was just talking to John about patients with these nonspecific list of symptoms that kind of endocrinologists and endocrine surgeons have recognized to be symptoms, but much less clear objectively. So the problem of asymptomatic primary hyperparathyroidism came to light with this huge increase in detection. And the idea is that this was defined in the NIH Consensus Development Conference in 1990, the clinical profile of patients with documented primary hyperpara without the symptoms or signs commonly attributed to the disease. So a little more about the consensus guidelines for the treatment of so-called asymptomatic primary hyperparathyroidism, and a little bit more about the NIH Consensus Development Program. It was established in 1977. It's a joint venture between the Office of Disease Prevention and a specific NIH institute or center dealing with the disease. And the idea is to produce a consensus statement on an important and controversial topic in medicine, with the goal of evaluating the available scientific evidence and producing a summary statement for health professionals and the public at large. So in 1990, they had the inaugural diagnosis and management of asymptomatic primary hyperparathyroidism, where they defined the asymptomatic disease and established clinical criteria for when the patients have surgery versus when it would be appropriate for them to be observed. And this is kind of interesting. This is from the proceedings of the meeting, some of the minutes of the meeting, where they quoted debate about how you should categorize patients with asymptomatic disease, and the idea comes out about a patient with vague symptoms that can't be definitively attributed. These are considered asymptomatic based on the consensus criteria, whereas patients with significant bone, renal, gastrointestinal, and neuromuscular symptoms are defined as symptomatic. And more gems from the basement of Galter. Yeah, that's the basement of the library at Northwestern, where I was looking at back in 1990 in the Journal of Bone Marrow Research, where they talk about people arguing about what should be symptomatic and asymptomatic. You know, this doctor pointed out the difficulty of sorting out issues of fatigue and lethargy within a practical limit of a patient interview. And this overlaps with chronic fatigue syndrome and the faculty at UCLA, as you say. These symptoms are so difficult to define, even if they could be revealed, it would be very difficult to use them as an argument for surgery. So that was the thought in 1990. And there have been four consensus conferences since then. So that tells us that there is no consensus if they're continuing to meet about this. And I'll tell you right now that the 2014 consensus guidelines have not changed much from 1990. Now they do say that, you know, surgery is always an appropriate treatment for primary hyperparathyroidism. It's the only definitive treatment. However, there are patients that are eligible for observation. People that need surgery, though, are those with severe hypercalcemia, less or greater than a milligram per deciliter above the upper limit of normal for your lab, osteoporosis, a history of fragility fracture or vertebral fracture, diminished creatinine clearance, very high urine calcium level, or an age less than 50, the thought being that the disease would progress with time.
That last one is an empirical question, right?
Absolutely. Right. And then we'll talk more about that as the talk goes on. So they also provided observation parameters for patients that are not having surgery, including an annual serum calcium creatinine measurement and a bone density scan every 1 to 2 years. Now they talk about vertebral fracture assessments and x-rays if people are experiencing height loss or back pain, and recommend intervening if someone has a vertebral fracture. So the thought among endocrine surgeons, my bias and many surgeons' biases are that surgery improves the medical outcomes by improving bone mineralization. There's good data that it does, even in patients with mild disease, much more mild than what's described as, you know, the explicit criteria for surgery. You eliminate surveillance costs, and you can improve quality of life after parathyroidectomy based on, you know, our experience with patients that come in and say that, you know, they feel crummy before surgery, and then after surgery, there's a cloud lifted from them, and they feel much better. And empirically, a lot of endocrine surgeons believe that.
That's an allegation. Right.
It's an allegation, and it's been studied, and I've studied it, and we'll talk about you know, what I found. But yeah, I mean, I think.
I mean, if you're saying, well, people come back and say they feel better, then we know placebo surgery.
Oh yeah.
So Mark Lightwood established that men who were injured before having prostate operations were at the age of 50% like more likely to be potent after operations.
Oh yeah, this is a huge issue. You know, there's all sorts of placebo effects, and I completely acknowledge that. But you know, there's a couple issues involving that, and I'll show you, you know, several cost effectiveness analyses that I've performed that have evolved over the years from really hinging upon improvement in quality of life to objective outcomes of improved bone mineralization and fracture reductions. We'll talk about that. Okay, so quality of life, cost effectiveness, patient-reported outcomes, and primary hyperparathyroidism. So there have been quality of life studies for primary hyperparathyroidism. These include a disease-specific symptom inventory, which was created by Janet Pasica. The hospital anxiety and depression scale has been applied to these patients, as well as SF-36. This is the Pasica parathyroid assessment of symptoms. It was published in 1998. It involved using a visual analog scale. It's unclear how Dr. Pasica arrived at these 13 symptoms that are most likely to respond to parathyroidectomy. However, this has been studied fairly extensively and in a prospective manner. Bone pain is kind of, you know, a later symptom of a patient with severe hypercalcemia, hyperparathyroidism. But a lot of these other ones, being forgetful, feeling weak, feeling irritable, headaches, you know, those kind of fit with what I was talking about earlier, these soft symptoms that it's unclear whether it's related to the disease or not. And she's looked at this several times over the years, and the bottom line is there was significant improvement in these symptoms scores postoperatively, and she's able to follow patients out as long as 10 years, and there is durable improvement in these symptom scores. However, there's no subgroup analysis of patients that are observation eligible, the so-called asymptomatic patients, versus the patients that would have required surgery anyways based on this consensus development criteria. So it's really unclear from these data about these patients that we're really most interested in, the ones that, you know, should they have surgery or should they be observed? You know, it's not clear.
So, is it just all one symptom score? All these things go together?
No, I think the way it worked was it's a visual analog scale. I think it was like 0 to 100 and for each one of those statements, you know, feeling depressed or feeling thirsty. I think that's how it worked. And I think they had the patients wrote a mark on this visual analog scale, and it was normalized into some sort of score that added all 13 together.
Okay, so it was a single score.
I think, yeah, there was a single score reported, and then there was also, you know, individual. Yeah.
What was going on in the control group?
Yeah, the control group were patients that had neck operations for benign thyroid disease. So they had like a thyroid lobectomy for a suspicious thyroid nodule that turned out to be benign. You know, they also did the symptom inventory before and after surgery. And some other small underpowered studies. One of these, they both looked at this hospital anxiety, depression, and mood rating scale. One group said that there was improvement immediately after surgery. Another group said no, but grossly underpowered. There's a theme here of not very good data. The SF-36 has been applied in three randomized prospective trials of surgery versus observation, with a 5 to 25% improvement in SF-36 scores compared to observation, namely in the bodily pain, general health, social and emotional role functioning, vitality, and mental health areas. The improvement was inconsistent among the three studies, but that it is what it is. So this actually kind of is a segue into my research. I came across the SF-36 data when I was doing my first cost effectiveness analysis, which I'll talk about in greater detail. But I used the SF-36 data and a regression equation to develop a quality adjustment factor for asymptomatic primary hyperparathyroidism. And I'll talk a little bit about how I did that and more about the studies that I worked on in training. So again, not super clear about the level of comfort with cost effectiveness analysis here in this room, but I'll take some time to talk about it a little bit.
You can go beyond that. We all know that. Just do it.
Okay, very good. And we know about the axis and the idea that okay, great.
You even knew what a parathyroid drug was.
That's great. And so then
I wanted you to do this before you did a cost effectiveness analysis. My sense is you left me with understanding that there's no evidence whatsoever that is reasonable about the efficacy of this procedure at all. That's how you left it.
Yeah, I think it is.
So why would you do a cost effectiveness analysis before you? I mean, if there's no evidence, is there an assumption that has to be this? Are you going to do this from the standpoint of this is the This is the range of difference that it had to make it cost effective. Because you have no evidence, you have nothing to put into the effectiveness part of the study.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say we had nothing. I think, you know, there is a opinion that patients have subjective improvement and have improvement in quality of life after surgery. There are some data, including data from the SF-36, which was translatable into a quality adjustment factor.
There's no drug trial. I mean, you don't have anything.
Well, I would say that is something, and that a cost effectiveness analysis with other variables can be pursued, and then threshold analysis can be performed to decide what, you know, what level of quality adjustment would be necessary to make parathyroidectomy cost effective for patients with asymptomatic disease. And that's how we started. And that's what I did, and that's what I'll show you. So you know all this, you know about, you know, setting a incremental cost effectiveness ratio of $100,000 today as being an acceptable consideration for cost effectiveness. And we hypothesize that parathyroidectomy is cost effective for patients with asymptomatic primary hyperpara who are older than 50. And our reference case was a patient that did not meet NIH criteria for surgery and was a healthy candidate for surgery, did not have a syndrome. And then, I've mixed together some of my work. You know, this was actually recently submitted, and the older studies were not as sophisticated. However, this is a Markov transition state model. It's simplified. However, the big development, and you've touched on this yourself. You said that there's not good evidence that we can have a quality adjustment factor for asymptomatic disease, but there is good evidence now that patients that are observation eligible have a increased relative risk of fracture if they don't have surgery, to the tune of a 30% increased risk. So we applied that knowledge in a Markov model that included quality adjustment for just being asymptomatic and for having the outcome of fracture while being observed. And this is a schematic of that. And I'm happy to talk about Markov modeling here. Maybe that's, again, a subject that everyone is familiar with.
Yeah.
John, are you...
Anyone need Markov modeling? No, I'll wait.
Not interested? No.
I'm interested.
Okay.
Right. But I don't
want to. Okay. So I think it's useful for some maybe to go over a Markov chain, which is basically just a system of transition states that a patient can move from over time, and it allows you to have different time periods spent with different degrees of detriment to quality of life. So you can ultimately calculate a quality-adjusted life expectancy using a Markov model, and you can use discounting to some degree of sophistication.
The main issue is the transition state from one state to the next. It only depends on the state you're currently in.
That's right.
Not how you got there.
That's exactly right.
All that is fine. The major issue is it's independent of your prior history.
That's exactly right, and that's why chutes and ladders, John, is a Markov model. So I liked this game when I was in preschool. You know, if you do something good, make a cake, you get to climb the ladder, and there, you know, you advance in the game, and you have a nice result. Cake. But if you're looking at comics instead of a history book, you have to go backwards in the game, and you're wearing a dunce hat. But the bottom line is there's no decision made during the game, as you were saying. There is a set probability, and it's only based on the position you're in. That's the Markov chain. So, you know, you have a 1 in 6 chance of rolling a 1, a 2, a 3, a 4, a 5, or a 6, and that's all it is. It's just a probability with a dice, and everybody in this game, if they played it long enough, would end up winning. But you know.
So there's two major surgical complications on the board.
Let's
go from 87 to 24. Let's, 62 to 92.
Let's see here. Oh, yeah. That looks bad. And what's the other one?
62 to 19.
Oof, yeah, that lacerations.
Whereas you would say, well, we're the surgeons. We take people from 28 to 84.
Aha, aha.
And yeah. We're the interns. We just roll the dice every day.
Uh-huh.
There's no ladders and there's no slits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good.
And then we pay him because we're depressed and we observe our calcium level,
right,
because of a lab error and we take your thyroid.
Oh, come on now. We check it twice. Everybody, you know, deserves a bad day. These are skeptical. Okay, so these are some of the assumptions that we used in the model. These are based on not the greatest evidence, but there is some evidence.
Let me ask a dumb question.
Okay.
If you say die, then I talk to a cardiologist, I'll think about a cardiologist.
Okay.
Tell you what he wants to do.
All right.
He wants to monitor the heart rate of everybody continuously. And he has a little thing that you put on you, like a little patch, a microdot. And he is convinced that everybody over the age of 60 has an episode of injury with their body.
Okay.
And then they don't know about it. And then he wants to treat everybody for that with Coumadin or whatever the latest treatment at this moment under the belief that it would decrease heart rate.
Okay.
And his argument is that the amount that you examine a person will determine the amount of pathology they have. So what do we know about monitoring calcium as often as we now monitor them in people? And if you monitor them that often, given lab error and human variability, what is the real level of normal that you really have to worry about? And how do you even set a value of normal if you're asymptomatic? Murphy wrote a whole book on that.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't know what, that's the science that is underdeveloped at this point, is how many observations you do. And so if I look at a chest x-ray, take 25 different chest x-rays, and some radiologist is going to find a nodule that they're going to be worried about because that day there was a shadow that, you know, the radiologist sees shadows or has a macro or whatever. But I know nothing about the frequency of ordering calciums now that they are already at the drop of it, whatever. And what really is normal? I wasn't being facetious.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, I would say, 10 point. If you're above 10.5, very abnormal, very abnormal. And the biochemical diagnosis of primary hyperparathyroidism is fairly straightforward. If you have an elevated parathyroid hormone level and an elevated calcium, and there's not a lot of things that can do that. I mean, low vitamin D, a little bit of a secondary.
No, we're not looking for another disease. I'm just looking for this is really normal.
Yeah, I calcium is a pretty tightly regulated thing in the human body.
So if I ask you if you're depressed every day of the week, I can guarantee you that on one day of the week, somebody's going to say, for a year.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, but I'm just trying to reiterate that we know that the frequency, the amount of cardiac disease a person has is dependent on how many cardiac exams they have.
Uh-huh.
Well, and also there's the issue of progression to the mean, and people tend to go to the doctor when they don't feel well. So
uh-huh.
You go to the doctor, you don't feel well, and you get some tests,
yeah,
and the calcium is off.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't mean you don't feel well the rest of the time. Or
uh-huh.
Feel better the rest of the time.
So what is calcium set at now? Most of the lab tests were set at that normal is 95%. You know how they're now setting.
Oh, that's a good question.
Setting. I mean, there was no way of determining what's normal. So what's a normal hematocrit or hemoglobin? I mean, there's no real answer to that question.
Yeah.
And people now have been using time trends better than. So some people who have a hemoglobin of 17 and they have it for 10 years, that's probably normal, or at least as we understand it.
Yeah.
So what is normal? What really, so given your interest in this area, what really is the history?
Yeah, I would say, a couple things. you know, there probably is a normal range that encompasses 95% of the population. A lot of people have, you know, fairly on the lower end of calcium because of, you know, their nutrition isn't perfect. And it's bound by protein in the blood. But I really, you know, I think that if you have a biochemical diagnosis of primary hyperparathyroidism, you've got the disease. It's not like, oh, I'm finding it more and more. These people are fine. You know,
you're talking about the people with the high calcium and the higher normal pH.
Yeah. So what, you know, whether you're detecting it more often because you're using the autoanalyzer and they're not, you know, breaking their hip or having bad kidney
stones. Most people are formed right at the borderline. Right. So 10.1, 10.2, and a normal parathyroid. I mean, you already mentioned you were growing that week, so I just don't know how do you really do this? I mean, I'm serious. I'm not trying to.
I think if the calcium is above 10.3 here at UCLA and their parathyroid hormone level is above the mean of the normal range, which is, you know, around 40, something like that, then you've got the
disease. You want to label them having a disease. That's once. Does that be a year apart, like in hypertension?
Could you look at outcomes?
What?
Could you measure outcomes in different ranges?
Well, probably not.
One other question is to say, if you're above the median, right?
Of parathyroid hormone levels, inappropriately.
Then you've got the disease. So couldn't we say no? You got the disease if you're able to make an anatomic diagnosis of hypoplastic.
Sure.
Gland,
absolutely. Yeah.
And because arguably with those cutoffs, if you had someone who is 12.3 and way above the range, you're more likely, when you do the surgery, to find the gland that's causing this. Than the person who's at the mean at 10.3, right?
It hasn't really borne out.
There is
pathologic.
There is predictive value data.
Not really. I'm trying to think of the last time we did a parathyroidectomy on someone, and the pathologist told us that we took out a normal parathyroid. In fact, I've never seen that. Normal cellular parathyroid removed.
There's a hyperplastic gland. They weigh more.
They can weigh more, but there's increased cellularity compared to fat. So, I mean, I cannot think of a time where they've said normal cellular. You know, sometimes there is definitely degree of hypercellularity. You know, they'll say mildly hyperplastic.
So essentially, no one ever gets operated on with normal lines.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
So
the first surgery that I know of, that's true.
It's a biochemical diagnosis.
With the appendix, they sort of slap it around a bit to get it defined.
Yeah, I had one like that a couple of weeks ago. Squeezed the tip of it after I took it out. I don't think that works though. They said it was mildly inflamed, but. I'm telling you that it's a biochemical diagnosis, and there's just not other things that cause primary hyperparathyroidism other than hyperplastic, you know, a genetic mutation.
Okay. But I would say, look, you know about like predictive value and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
I mean, I'm a surgeon.
So if everyone above the mean and above 10.3 has hyperparathyroidism, then some people at lower levels of one or both of those variables must have hyperparathyroidism.
Yeah, that's called normal calcemic hyperparathyroidism, which is a debatable topic, but we do.
Okay. Anyways, go on.
It's funny, yeah.
I'm going to have to leave in a few minutes.
Yeah. Well, so anyway, you know, these are the probabilities we use in our transitions. Get through this somewhat quickly because... some more probabilities. We used Medicare reimbursement for cost data. And, you know, came up with inpatient and outpatient costs, and this is based on Medicare reimbursement, and then these quality adjustment factors. You know, several references have used the time trade-off method and the standard gamble approach and the Euroqual survey, all that kind of stuff, to come up with some quality adjustment factors for some of the major complications and results of surgery for primary hyperparathyroidism.
So are those based on people in those groups actually having those scores, or judges saying that's what they would rate those states on?
Yeah, not people with the disease, judges. Yeah. And I kind of got into this a little bit. You know, long-term hypoparathyroidism, for example, it's, again, I think maybe talking to a sophisticated group here, so we don't have to talk too much about, you know, you could probably tell me about quality adjusted life expectancy. However, this is just some stuff about calculating quality adjusted life expectancy and is there a such thing as a negative quality adjustment factor? It'd be interesting to some people here. And then it sounds like everybody knows how to do this already. So Sean, what's the quality adjusted life expectancy for this patient?
8 years.
Yeah. And then this talks about the different techniques of estimation of quality adjustment factors. And yeah, like Dr. Hayes was saying, you're supposed to ask people who don't have the condition in question, because you're taking a societal perspective. And this is what the legislature says about that, death panels. Okay, so what is the quality adjustment factor for permanent iatrogenic hypoparathyroidism? We were kind of talking about the chutes and ladders, surgeons introduce complications. One of the major things that we are worried about is permanent hypoparathyroidism, which is a serious complication after thyroid and parathyroid surgery, leaving patients requiring lifelong calcium and activated vitamin D treatment, and weakness, paresthesias, trips to the emergency room for serum calcium measurements, calcium infusions. And then there's the risk of vitamin D toxicity as you try to treat them with calcitriol and they get kidney stones. So a bad problem. And there's support groups online about this. I'm unable to work. I'm continually tired. So this is just an exercise in how you would come up with a quality adjustment factor for permanent hypoparathyroidism using some of the different described techniques, including a visual analog scale. Select a point that represents your hypoparathyroidism. Well, that's easy to administer, but there's no forced trade-off, there's no utility, so it's criticized for that reason. The time trade-off, now we get into some of the things that were used to come up with the estimates that I quoted. Imagine yourself living with 10 years of hypoparathyroidism. How many years out of those 10 would you be willing to give up to be in excellent health for a shorter amount of time? Now we have a trade-off here that is good. It's preference-based. It's more precise. But when you start to think about administering this to the general public and having them understand, it becomes more problematic. And then even more problematic would be the standard gamma approach. Now it introduces risk, but you have this elaborate scenario that you have to administer to the general public. Arguably is not going to be well understood. So a somewhat, a reason for criticism, I would say. So there's really no perfect way to have a quality adjustment factor for something as complicated as hypoparathyroidism. You can certainly, as I did for you, describe the scenario of having to take trips to the emergency room and having lethargy and tetany and whatever other issues you may encounter, and then you can think critically about coming up with the quality adjustment factor for that. But it's a tall order. And then there's survey-based systems, including Euroqual, which you probably are familiar with. So imagine you had permanent hypoparathyroidism. What would be the most appropriate response based on what I told you? Can you walk around the neighborhood without difficulty? Are you able to walk this and that? and then this becomes a score and eventually a quality adjustment. Easy administer. It systematically returns lower quality adjustment factors than the other methods. For intermittent claudication, for example, the survey-based one said 0.61, whereas the standard gamble says 0.85.
Wait a second.
So sure. Yeah, yeah.
So, this is one of the one default.
Uh-huh. Here?
Yeah, so it's healthy. It's like the health utilities index. So that's what I was asking earlier. You think these are all judges saying what the state is like? You don't think there were people who filled out the health utilities index and then they got a score from other?
Oh, I see what you're saying. So I thought you meant, are they people with the disease being asked?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Sorry about that.
No, that's all right.
No, it was like 100 healthy volunteers, something like that.
The reason I'm asking so much is it seems like the way you're describing all this, no one's going to really know unless they have the condition. So you have to have a lot of descriptive information to describe the condition to people, which would be very difficult to do, versus you gave them the healthy abilities index and then said, people in these different bins, this is how they differ. And we applied the standard healthy abilities index weights to people who fill out the HUI. It seems like it's the only practical way to get those different weights that you need for the states that you're differentiating.
Yeah, it seems that way to me. But I think it's hard. I think there's trade-offs in asking one versus the other. I think it's an imperfect order to ask someone to come up with the quality adjustment factor for something complicated. Maybe you're right. Maybe having a survey is the only way to really arrive at it, or maybe that's the most practical. But some of the other studies that I was talking about, in fact, I think it comes up in the next slide here, and they used a variety of different approaches to coming up with quality adjustment factors for patients undergoing surgery for thyroid conditions and parathyroid conditions.
Yeah, I think most of those, if they say SF-36, that probably was administered rather than using a survey for judges to rate it. It's probably...
Well, this SF-36, it's literally, there's a paper that says you can plug in the results of an SF-36 survey into a regression equation and we'll tell you what the quality adjustment factor is.
Right, well, that's what I'm saying. The SF-36 and the HUI, you can estimate the preference for it.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm assuming they're getting the estimates from.
I mean, that's what I did in 2006 to come up with a 0.894. But Sejean in Paris used the time trade-off method, and they asked 100 healthy people about permanent hyperparathyroidism and came up with that number. So there's some variation. But yeah, I agree. I think you're right in stating that it's a tall order to have someone be presented with a scenario, and then to try to make a preference based judgment about the disease. So in all these cost effectiveness analyses, we have to define the optimal strategy. And in this case, it's the most effective treatment that did not exceed an incremental cost effectiveness ratio of $100,000 per quality gain. And the results of the most recent cost effectiveness analysis looking at parathyroidectomy versus observation in a patient with asymptomatic disease that's over the age of 50, we found that parathyroidectomy was less expensive and more effective to the tune of 0.19 qualities. I'll show you some sensitivity analysis that kind of supports this, but observation was not cost effective and it was actually dominated. So this is a Monte Carlo simulation where we looked at all the variables in the model, including the relative risk of fracture and all the different utility estimates. We used the triangular distribution and varied it plus or minus 50% of the center value. And this is what we got. The majority of the iterations fell into the dominant range, or parathyroidectomy was, you know, less costly and had a higher quality adjusted life expectancy than observation. There were very few where observation was considered cost effective. A major variable of sensitivity was life expectancy. If the remaining life expectancy for a patient was less than 3 years, then the incremental cost effectiveness for surgery was a lot higher. Basically because, you know, all the future costs of monitoring the patient, having recurrent disease, needing reoperation, having a fracture, having all those things, you know, with only 3 years of life expectancy, unlikely that all the upfront costs and risks of surgery are going to make a difference. But, I mean, after 3 years, and it was cost effective, and the threshold for dominance was 16 years. So really, a patient that's 70 years or younger, our analysis shows that parathyroidectomy is the dominant strategy. So Dr. Shapiro, I believe his name is, was mentioning that the 50 year cutoff is a point of contention, a point of study. And I mean, we would argue that 70 years would be a better cutoff than 50 years based on what we found. And then our reference case was 24 years. It was a 60 year old patient, a female, and we used just the Social Security actuarial prediction for their life expectancy. So yes, parathyroidectomy is cost effective if your life expectancy is greater than 3 years. That's what we found most recently. And dominant if your age is less than 70. So I told you a little bit about previous work using these disease-specific inventories and the SF36 health survey. But I also did a prospective study using the NIH PROMIS system on patients with primary hyperparathyroidism. So maybe you know about PROMIS already. I know Dr. Hayes does. But this is a standard set of tools that collects patient-reported outcomes divided into health domains, not disease-specific, but there's domains of physical, mental, and social health. And PROMIS returns a T-score as a method of measurement for all the domains, with 50 being the population average, a standard deviation of 10. You can use computer adaptive testing. And in the computer adaptive testing algorithm for the PROMIS instruments, it always starts out with the same question, but then subsequent items are selected based on your previous responses. So this is an example of a fatigue a chain of questioning. The first question, how often do you have to push yourself to get things done? Never, rarely, sometimes, always. And depending on how you answer your first question, then it'll ask you a different question. You know, if you say never, then, you know, another question is, or whether you ever feel fatigued. This one, you know, if you're saying always, then they're going to get into details about how bad is your fatigue. And then this algorithm continues until an acceptable standard error is achieved. Computer adaptive testing is widely used now, including on the GRE and probably on the MCAT eventually. So the idea here is that you have this wide range of possible values for fatigue, and you can quickly arrive at a precise estimate from a wide range using computer adaptive testing. Item response theory is the buzzword. So we wanted to measure these so-called softer symptoms of primary hyperparathyroidism that are currently not used in the consensus guidelines that recommend surgery. And we wanted to do this in an efficient manner in a clinical encounter. We hypothesized that primary hyperparathyroidism patients report improved mental and physical health after undergoing successful parathyroidectomy, when compared to control patients undergoing surgery for benign thyroid nodules. And and that this improvement occurs in both patients that are considered symptomatic by the guidelines and asymptomatic or observation eligible based on the guidelines. So we selected 12 of the promised domains that we thought were the most relevant to primary hyperparathyroidism, and we enrolled patients during a 6-month period. We looked at patients having parathyroidectomy for primary hyperpara, and then patients undergoing, similar to what I was talking about earlier, the control patients in the Basica studies, patients having neck surgery for a benign thyroid disease. And we administered the item bank in their preoperative appointment and in their 3-week postoperative appointment. These are the physical health domains we used. And then these are the mental health domains. I'll try to, I think we're probably short on time here. But, and then these are the patients that we were able to accrue it in the 6-month period. Fairly similar in their age, sex, distributions. Not, can't really say much about the other ones, but there were no significant differences among the two groups. Of the 53 patients with primary hyperparathyroidism that we approached, some were excluded because they had concurrent thyroid cancer or used a mobility aid. There's a special promise inventory for patients using mobility aids, and we decided it'd be best to just leave them out. 45% completed the preoperative assessment. 40 patients had curative parathyroidectomy. Some postponed their surgery and didn't undergo surgery. And one was lost to follow-up. One patient had persistent disease after surgery. Ultimately, 66% of our patients completed a post-operative assessment. And then 13 thyroid controls. They all were able to... 10 of the 13 completed a preoperative assessment, and 9 ended up getting all the way to post-operative follow-up. And then here's some data about the computer adaptive testing. We were able to ask patients about the 12 domains in a median completion time of 7.5 minutes. So pretty practical for a clinical encounter. The range of completion time was wide, but I'll tell you, I know this outlier had a phone call in the middle of the assessment, and that's why it extended the time. And I think there were a couple other issues with these. And then the other thing is, you know, you think maybe that, you know, the patients that required a lot of questions to arrive at their domain score with an acceptable standard error would also take a lot of time, but that was not the case. People were able to quickly move through their questions to arrive at the end of the assessment. So here are results. This is so. So there was improvement in all the patients who had surgery for primary hyperparathyroidism. There was statistical significance reached. This is just the preoperative score versus the postoperative score. And then there's some sign differences based on, you know, anxiety being a bad thing, cognition being a good thing. So we had to flip some signs around. But basically, there's statistically significant improvement in several domains. And then we define clinical significance as having an improvement of 5 or greater, half the standard deviation or greater between the preoperative assessment and the postoperative assessment.
Yeah, this looks like when you talked about the SF36 results, that they were primarily mental health improvements, and seems like you're getting some results there.
Yes. And that's what we get with patients, and that's what we empirically, that's what we see when we talk to patients. That's what they'll tell us. So this fits with kind of the surgeon's bias about this idea of the cloud being lifted, et cetera. And then these are the control patients. Nobody had improvement in the control patients. And actually, there was worsening in the pain intensity and physical function. I will say that thyroidectomy is... it involves more surgery than parathyroidectomy. There's more muscle splitting to get the gland out. So it's not a perfect control. And I think that probably explains why the pain intensity, you know, was worse in this group compared to the parathyroidectomy group. And the same thing with the physical function. And, you know, this is way underpowered. We can't really say anything about...
So these are asymptomatic thyroid nodules?
Yeah. Just people that, you know, their doctor felt a nodule and they got biopsy as indeterminate, and they needed a lobectomy to diagnose the condition.
So they have the same level of these mental health symptoms prior to surgery?
Let's see if I can answer your questions. So 50 is considered the average in the promised population. So the thyroid patients, you know, pain intensity, they were lower than average. Everything else is pretty close. Cognition, concerns about cognition, lower than average. But pretty much everybody else is fits with the general population. And then after surgery, you know, still the pain intensity is still not as high as the general population, but a definite worsening, which can be attributable to surgery.
What I really don't understand is when you do parathyroid surgery,
uh-huh.
You tell, are those values higher in the parathyroid group?
Slightly higher, yes.
Not much. I mean, is that enough?
Yeah, if you compared this group, the preoperative group, to the general population, I would say there's no difference really, other than maybe they're less concerned about their...
So they became better than the average? Most of.
Well, yeah, and somewhat. Yeah.
So you tell them that they're going to get better when you operate them?
No. No, we tell them that we're doing the surgery to... prevent bone health down the line, basically. You tell them that...
You never mentioned, so if I did a script and all this, you never mentioned that when they come in, so they're not coming in for any of these symptoms and you don't tell them they're going to get better by any.
Well, a lot of patients have read about primary hyperparathyroidism and the internet is just full of stuff about this idea of, you know, fatigue and cognitive malfunction. And so a lot of patients come into our office saying
so
that they're
cognition, sick. I don't really understand. It's much better than average to begin with in this group.
Yeah, I mean, part of this
and
is probably the...
Really, really good. I mean, I don't know what 29 is on, what's that, in standard deviations?
10.
So you're in the top 1% of the population in the world. I mean, the top...
Yeah, you know, I think
anesthesia increased cognition.
Well, I think one way to explain this
they
is
became hyperhumans. I don't understand it.
Well, I think it's probably the way that the initial promise was set. I mean, I don't know why this is very 38.1 is very similar to our control group.
But that's subjective. That's just if they're concerned about their condition.
Yeah. It's an elective surgical population. It's at Northwestern University. The patients are affluent. I was more interested in the pre and the post than comparing it to the general. This is a new thing. I was more interested in improvement with time than what the baseline said. But no, I think, you know, I think looking at this, I'd say there's something wrong with the instrument. Why would thyroid patients and parathyroid patients have, you know, that much of a difference from about concern about their cognition compared to the general population?
Yeah. But why is the thyroid population, even the thyroid, that number? I mean, that's a huge difference. It's marginally significant. I mean, why does surgery on the thyroid improve cognition? There's nothing in the way you're asking these people these questions. I mean, something is screwy here.
You know, I don't. It didn't improve. Thyroid surgery didn't. Did it
look like it?
It got a little worse. This is the thyroid one. Oh yeah. Oh no, you're right. I'm so sorry. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a short question.
It improved anger? I mean, the numbers are, I mean, I understand you have so small numbers of people.
Yeah.
But you got a p-value of 0.06 with 9 patients. I mean, that, in my book.
Well, I can see, well.
People, a lot of people would like to get thyroid surgery.
Well. Well, think if you walk into an office and you have to have surgery because you have an indeterminate thyroid nodule and you may have cancer, I could see where, you know, 3 weeks later when you've been diagnosed, we know that these patients do not have cancer and they've been provided with that information, it's possible that, you know, that's an explanation, I think. Maybe their subjective anger is lower after they've had their definitive surgery and don't have cancer. I think that's a plausible explanation for that.
Yeah, you've been through surgery, you're relieved, so maybe a lot of this stuff is just feeling good that you've been through it.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's true.
And these are people who did not have major complications.
Yeah, none of these patients had a major complication. But yeah, the pain was worse. Very small, you know, obviously you can't really draw conclusions about the negative part of it. But then we compared, so this is where we compared the magnitude of improvement in the parathyroid surgery group versus the benign thyroid surgery group. And the areas that, you know, stood out the most and were statistically and clinically significant were fatigue, cognitive ability, sleep impairment, depression, and anxiety. And then this is where we looked at the patients that had parathyroidectomy who either met the NIH criteria for operation or did not meet the criteria for operation. And we just compared the improvement between the two groups, and the only difference was interest in sexual activity. Those who did not meet criteria had an increased interest in sexual activity compared to those who did not. There were no other differences, but very, you know, no power really. I think our power is like 23%, something like that. But I mean, there's no real difference between the patients that met criteria and didn't meet criteria based on what we did. So we concluded that PROMIS is an efficient clinical assessment platform for patient-reported outcomes in primary hyperparathyroidism. We saw short-term improvement in several domains after parathyroidectomy. But obviously, we'd like to look at this again much further down the road to see if there's any durability or improvement. And then sample size was a major limitation. Obviously, it'd be helpful to use, you know, multiple centers and multiple settings. What's nice about PROMIS is it's web-based, and potentially this could be an email and web-based study that, you know, we could look at multiple centers doing parathyroidectomy and see if we can increase our power. And it would also be very interesting to have enough patients to model the concentrations of serum calcium and parathyroid hormone and see if that predicts, you know, worsening function, or conversely, if you correct the biochemical disease, does the degree of correction correlate to the symptoms, which we have not been able to, you know, empirically see. So I'd like to thank some of my mentors, Dr. Ye here, my mentors at Northwestern, and thank you for inviting me to come talk and for your provocative questions. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
So a general question, how many people who you observe, you know, end up having surgery?
Around 30% over a 10-year period. So, well, 30% over a 10-year period develop a strict indication for
surgery.
An
NIH indication?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, I'm not sure. Probably a few more decide they want to have surgery for one reason or another. But the studies have shown, you know, 30% will go on to meet an
we have an indication for surgery.
Yeah, I think a lot of these symptoms, once you know you have a calcium that's higher, you start thinking about your anger, your anxiety, your irritability, and you start relating it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, a lot of people come begging us a lot of people think they have primary hyperpara and they don't have it biochemically.
So are you in favor of measuring calcium on everybody every year? Based on all...
I'm not in favor of screening for primary hyperpara.
You just proved that it was the dominant... I thought you said it was the dominant thing without even looking at quality of life. Would you screen?
It's costly.
I mean, screening for calcium is nothing.
Because it's so cheap and you can...
Just suppress it. It's all a game of charging. I think it costs virtually nothing. It's done even though we don't report it. If you don't order it. Something like that. I forgot where they are these days. But it's almost...
Yeah,
so,
I get the whole batch with me.
I mean, where do you go with all of this?
Well, I think where I would go with this is to change the age recommendation to 70 from 50. I mean, 50 is there's basically an acknowledgement that bone health is worse with time, even with asymptomatic disease.
I can imagine that this is becoming like hypertension. I don't know if this is enough data, but that we're going to take the normal values all the way down, and then we're going to say for bone health, we ought to remove parathyroids that are at the, you know, that are, when you have a calcium of 9.6, you know, and a normal thyroid
then you don't have biochemical primary hyperpara.
Is this going to be like hypertension, where when I began, 115 diastolic was normal. That was normal. We treated 116 or higher, and now we treat 70, and some people treat 60 or higher. And so the question is, this is all fake, the way these determinants think it's normal. So are we going to, you view a world that 20 years from now, part of the ritual growing up will be you remove your thyroid, your parathyroids?
Tonsils.
You know, it's like tonsils, going the opposite way of tonsils.
I don't think that.
It'd be more like retirement.
I guess it seems like people get.
If we could make the operation, if we had a Star Wars operation, which we just zapped it out, which we will. So the Israelis are developing a mechanism that's going to eliminate surgery. They have a beam that they can control so precisely that they can kill exactly what they want to kill. So if you could put your head in 2 seconds, and it takes 10 seconds. You can put yourself under this machine. The only harm you do is you zap out 3 of the parathyroids. Will you be a healthier person?
I don't think. I would guess that most people exposed to the modern medicine get a calcium every year, you know, when they go to the doctor. And I doubt that the incidence of primary hyperpara is going to go up much more than, like I said, 140,000 a year in the United States. So I don't
think pathology is good enough. So we're not going to have a pre-pathologic. This is not going to go like diabetes. It's the same model of disease. Yeah. I'm just wondering.
No, the whole idea of normal calcium.
Somebody's going to come along and say this is clearly like the appendicitis issue. Now that we're going to treat appendicitis, wipe out surgery and appendicitis and treat it with all antibiotics.
Yeah.
Are we going to have a fundamental revolution here?
In the treatment of primary hyperpara? Well, I think we do see patients referred to us with osteoporosis who have, mildly elevated.
I'm sure you do, because osteoporosis is a prevalence of 40%.
And then their doctor will send them to us because they barely meet the indications for parathyroid.
Do you remove the parathyroids?
Well, it's a case by case basis.
Yes, is the answer. They need the cases. I don't know. New disease.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Kyle, for doing this.
All right, take care.
That's